Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. On this edition, we're going to be speaking to UK-based author Carrie Hunter, and you'll hear the frankly fabulous chat we had very, very shortly. But before we get to that, we're going to do our usual rundown of what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts. And I'll also be filling you in on what I've been up to since the start of the year. Yes, we're in 2016. It's like we're in some, you know, futuristic space world, isn't it? But it's not. It's just now. We don't have hoverboards like they thought in Back to the Future, but we do have, you know, hover things, those things with wheels where that keep blowing up and exploding. I'm not going to get one because I once tried to go on a Segway when I was in Madrid last year and it didn't go well. Let's just put it this way. I don't do ice skating. I don't do roller skating. I don't do skiing. I'm not very good at things that I can't control. I like to be on solid ground with my feet on the ground. I'm very grounded. It's the kind of person I am. So hoverboards and me are not going to go well. Anyway, let's get to the Amazon charts. First up, so this January, Harper Bliss, who appeared on episode 7 of the podcast, well, she's going great guns, I have to say. Her two most recent releases, Seasons of Love and Release the Stars, they're featuring in both the US and UK top tens, which is quite some achievement. So well done, Harper. It's not really a surprise, though, as she is her style's really fluid and she's a master storyteller, too. So if you haven't tried one of her books, highly recommended. Also, crashing into both top fives is Rachel Maldonado with her book Touchdown Hero. As the title might suggest, it's about a college jock who meets the woman of her dreams. But I think the cover on this one is also the killer blow here too, because the woman on the cover is the spit of a young Angelina Jolie. So who doesn't want to buy that? And so it's proving. So well done, Rachel. Great story and great cover. And as usual, J.A. Armstrong is also a contender in the top five in both countries. She's a staple every month, it seems, with her long-running series. Also up there is Jerry Hill's Chasing a Brighter Blue. Now, as we all know, Jerry can knock out a great story. She's done it time after time. And Chasing a Brighter Blue also has a winning cover because it features like a moose or an elk with a Santa hat on. Now, who doesn't like that? We need more animals with Santa hats on covers, people. So writers, publishers, if you're listening, please take note. Maybe we can have a dog or a monkey. I mean, you know, we saw the success of Lila Bruce's last book, which had a dog with a pearl necklace. Let's have animals with accoutrement. What's the word I'm looking for? Not accoutrement. But hats and scarves and glasses and jewellery. Yeah, accessories. That's the word I'm looking for. Let's accessorize animals, people. That's the challenge for 2016. Let's go for it. I'll try and do it on a cover coming up. Also up there in the UK charts is Catherine Ryan Hyde's The Language of Hoofbeats. Now, this one doesn't have an animal with any accessories on the front, unfortunately, but it has garnered quite a few awards over the last year. And the author is a New York Times bestseller to boot. Plus, on the US site, it's got nearly 800 reviews, which means plenty of people are reading it and agreeing. So maybe that one's worth taking a look at, too. And that is the first chart roundup of 2016. Very exciting stuff. So how is January going for you? I hope it's going well and I hope you've come into the new year all fired up and ready to go. I know I have. I've had a really, really productive January and it's not over yet. So I'm hoping to have a great last 10 days. I'm recording this on January the 23rd. So yeah, I'm hoping to have a great last sort of week of the month. So far this January, it's been freezing in the UK. So I've had the heating on while I've been cranking out the words, which is good. I've been to a wedding, which was ace, and I've also been to the darts. And if you're UK based, you'll know that the Arrows is an institution in the UK. So it was fantastic to go to watch the live darts. We had 4-pint jugs of beers. We sang, you know, great classics like Daydream, Believer and Sweet Caroline with our arms in the air. And I got to meet Bobby George, legend of the darts. So that was great. The only issue I had, and slight sadness of the evening, was that they'd sold out of foam fingers. But, you know, I did have a sign that said 180. So all was not lost. But work-wise, 2015 was a great year for me professionally, as I revealed in my blog recently, where I stated what I'd learnt over the past 12 months. First up, I wrote and published two novels, This London Love and All I Want for Christmas. And that was from scratch, which I was really proud of. And second, I sold books in countries further afield than the usual, like, you know, UK, US and major European countries, Canada and Australia. But I also sold books in countries like Malaysia, Mexico, Indonesia and India. Only countries with letters that start from the middle of the alphabet. Only M and I, for some reason. And Nashville Public Library has also bought my whole back catalogue, which is awesome. But it just shows that bookselling is a global game, and it's really, really cool to think of all these people all over the world reading my books. So, yeah, that was really cool. I didn't make any New Year's resolutions. My key one is just to write and publish more. And in 2016, my aim is to publish two full-length novels. One is the conclusion of my London series, and the other one I've started, and I've yet to come up with a title. As you know, you may or may not know, but I'm rubbish at thinking up titles, so I really need to double down and think up a title. So that's two full-length novels, and then I'm also going to get a couple of short stories out there. And also, I'm going to be writing a new lesbian romance series of novellas, the All I Want series. Yes, it started at Christmas with All I Want for Christmas, but I found I couldn't leave the characters Tori and Holly there. I just couldn't. So I decided I'm going to write a series of shorter books, novellas, that follow the couple throughout the year as their relationship develops. And I'm really excited about this. So All I Want for Valentine's is the next book, and that's coming out on January the 29th, 2016. So it may or may not be out already by the time you hear this. So if it isn't, mark it in your diary. Must buy that book when it comes out. And if it's already gone, January 29th has passed, rush down to your local digital retailer and buy it now. Yes, the continuation of Tori and Holly's story. And then All I Want for Spring will be out a couple of months later. And I'll be peppering little novellas throughout the year. So I hope you'll follow Tori and Holly's journey. And I can't wait to write them. But anyway, that's enough about me. Let's get to the interview with the fantastic Carrie Hunter. I hope you enjoy. So joining me today on the Lesbian Book Club is lesbian crime author and Northerner Supreme, Carrie Hunter. Last year, as well as juggling her full-time job as a paramedic, Carrie released two novels, No Good Reason and Cold to the Touch, and she's quickly becoming the lesbian crime writer of choice. She lives in the northwest of England with her wife and two cats, bakes a mean Bakewell tart and is fond of a chippy tea. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you very much. That's probably one of the best introductions I've ever had.
Oh, well, I'm pleased. Did that just about, cover you?
That pretty much hit all of the bases, yes.
Yeah, good.
Yes, I think so.
Good, nothing else to add?
No, apart from the fact that I have that cat that I was warning you about now circling the kitchen. So if you hear any meows, it's not me, it's him.
Okay. If you hear any meows, it's the cat. And what have you been up to today? Anything exciting?
Today I have mainly been recovering from my last set of night shifts, which largely involves me sort of sitting around and staring into space while my brain tries to kick in. I did manage to get a bit of writing done, and I hoovered everywhere, so go me! That's about it. Oh, and I've been discussing biscuits on Facebook because that's one of my favourite subjects.
Oh yes.
As anybody who knows me from there will know.
I did see that. Do you have a favourite biscuit?
Oh God. With a brew? Bourbons, I think.
Right. Old school. Retro.
Old school. Yeah, very, very. And they're the ones that we can pinch from the hospitals as well. The NHS biscuit of choice as well.
So now we're getting the real reason.
Yeah. Biscuits, Bourbons or custard cream?
They're good. I like both those. So paint a picture for the listeners of where you're speaking to me from today.
I am in my kitchen, staring at a fruit bowl and some green checkered curtains and trying to corral my cat, who is circling, thinking that because I'm in the kitchen, there is food pending.
Oh, right, okay.
Which is not the case.
Has he been fed?
He's already and stolen half of my chicken for my tea.
Right. So he's had enough food.
He's definitely had enough food.
You need to be firm. You just need to be firm. Yeah.
Just a little scalp.
So tell me a bit about your writing journey and how you got started and when that was.
Oh, God. Years ago. And it was probably less of a journey and more of an accidental adventure, really. It wasn't anything that was planned. My wife, she knew that I was a writer. I dabbled in a little bit of fanfic. Mm-hmm. And then fallen out of the habit. And she, when I asked her what she wanted for Christmas one year, she said, write me a story. So I did that, really. I started writing her this story, which then became Snowbound, my first novel. Mm-hmm. It was never intended to be a novel. It was never intended to be read by anybody but her, which probably explains its kind of unconventional structure and the fact that it's written in the broadest of Northern English, because she speaks Northern English having lived with me, so I didn't have to worry about, you know, anybody needing to translate. Mm-hmm. It actually took ages to write. I got caught up writing a huge Sarah Connor Terminator fanfic series right in the middle of it and put it on hold and then came back to it.
Right.
And then when it was done, we knew of Ball Strokes through going to the York Arts Festival, the Lesbian Arts Festival. Mm-hmm. Radcliffe, the sort of commander-in-chief of Ballstrokes, used to go there. And we liked the story enough to send it in, just on the off chance, really. I didn't expect anything to come of it. And they surprised the hell out of me by offering me a contract. So my wife got her Christmas present, and I became a bit of an accidental novelist. But it gave me the kick up the ass that I needed to sort of write, you know, get properly back into the habit of writing, and I've not really stopped since then.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when was that? When was that published?
Oh, I can't actually remember. 2011, I think it was.
2011, okay.
It's been about one a year, and I'm on book 5 now. So, yeah, about 2011.
Right,
and you said... I've been writing it a couple of years before that, easily.
Right, and you said it took you a while to write that. So how long, what sort of scale was that? How long did that take?
It probably a couple of years. But sort of like on and off. Like mm-hmm. I say, I wrote 100,000 words plus of this Terminator fan fiction in the middle of it and got caught up in that and then came back to Snowbound.
So have you used any of the fan fiction in sort of the future novels? No?
None of my fanfics ever been adapted to novels. They've all been sort of... I've never written uberfic, you know, the sort of Xena-type fic that a lot of lesfics have grown out of. I've never done that. They've all been set so firmly into the sort of like the series and the I've never not used the right names. You know, I've always used the names of the characters.
Right. They're definitely in that world.
Yeah, they're set in that world. So. Yeah. Plus, I'm kind of a firm believer that fanfic should stay online and be free. Mm-hmm. Not really into publishing it for a profit. So
yeah,
that's just my personal. It's a personal hang-up of mine, having been a fan for a very, very long time.
Yeah, but like you say, I mean, having done... I'd never heard of fan fiction before I started sort of writing, and then it's huge, isn't it? And there's so much of it everywhere. And like you say, a lot of lesbian fiction writers started off doing Xena, so...
Yeah.
So I read both of your recent novels in preparation for this interview.
And did you actually get through them both?
I did. I managed it. Yay, go me. And I love them both, got to say. Really, really great stories. I love
the dialogue and the realism throughout them. And they both got very meaty whodunits in them, and they delve into the lives of Detective Sanna Jensen and her best mate Meg Fielding and their on-and-off relationship. So tell me about writing No Good Reason, which is about a kidnapping. Got them the right way round,
right?
You've
got them the right way round.
Yay!
No Good Reason is book one. I think I got the crime book while I was writing Tumble Down, which was the follow-up that I wrote to Desolation Point. That was my second novel, so Tumble Down was my third. Tumble Down continued the relationship of the couple and then branched off into a sort of police procedural crime investigation kind of story plotline. And I really enjoyed writing that. I've always enjoyed reading crime series.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like my favourites are the ones where you get involved with the characters and, you know, the case is there, but it's the characters that kind of carry you through onto the next book. And I was finding it difficult to sort of keep writing the standalone romances, the type, you know, the sort of snowbound Desolation Point where you write it and you're supposed to say goodbye to those characters after one book. I wanted to try my hand at a series, basically. I thought a police procedural where you've got one investigation that kind of forms the basis of the plot, and then you've got the development of characters going on in the background, and those characters you can carry on through to the next book, would give me a little bit more scope to just to broaden my horizons a little bit, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I just found the standalones a little bit too limiting. I wanted to give, you know, that depth that would come from a series to a set of characters, basically.
Yeah, and you do get right into the nitty-gritty of the police work and procedure. I take it you had to do quite a lot of research on that.
Yeah, there's loads of research I've done. I mean, quite lucky because my day job sort of... I work alongside the police a lot.
Yeah.
So you get to sort of like know a little bit of procedural aspects, and I've got a few contacts that I can plug for information. But a lot of it is kind of hard graft on the internet. I mean, I try to get the language right and the technical aspects right, and I wanted to make it as realistic procedurally as I could. So basically there's, you know, that involves a lot of knocking on doors and asking the right questions and the characters pulling suspects in for interviews. It doesn't happen overnight, you know, they don't suddenly happen on the solution overnight. It's just the grafting at it, basically.
Yeah, no, that really comes over, actually. And I could picture it all in my head. It was like, you know, it was kind of like watching an episode of, you know, like Scott and Bailey or something.
Yeah, see Sally Rainwright, the writer of Scott and Bailey, who did Happy Valley as well. She's somebody that I really do admire.
Yeah.
Because she's one of the few writers who gets it right. She gets the sort of language right, and she gets the procedural aspect. You know, you can imagine that is actually how it is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And she's got great characters as well, like you have in these books. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that you care about.
I mean, my day job helps there as well, because I get to go into all sorts of homes. I sort of like the good, the bad are the ones where you wipe your feet on the way out. So I can constantly kind of make mental notes for future use.
Right.
And then plug into the internet. I mean, God knows what I'm probably on so many watch lists now, it's not even funny, some of the things that I've actually Googled.
Yeah. And I was going to say that, how much of your real-life job as a paramedic drips through to the books? Is it just the, you know, that, like you say, the interiors of homes, but is there other things that drip through, like actual cases?
Oh, there's loads of sort of like little deep details and snippets, but nothing so that an actual patient would ever recognise themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, the general idiocy of some of the people that I deal with is something that I like to put on Meg, because basically stupid people are funny. But, you know, A&E work is sort of 99% bread and butter jobs. You're sort of water infections, you falls, you drunks.
Yeah.
The generally unwell, the slightly crazy. And, you know, 1% you super dramatic traumas. They're quite rare, those jobs. And I think working in the NHS, you kind of have to laugh at some of it, otherwise you probably spend your entire time bawling.
Yeah.
I mean, cold touches on some of the stuff that is affecting the NHS at the moment. It's kind of political in a way. You know, sort of like bits of it are quite political, with closing hospitals and winter pressures and, you know, ambulance crews in the corridors and the pressure on staff to get things done. So that was quite interesting to write. And I think in terms of all of my novels, it's one of the ones that's it's been closest to, you know, to my heart. Now, the hospital is designed on the hospital that I take all my patients into, you know, that kind of thing.
It's, right.
Yeah, it's quite close to home.
Do your colleagues know that you write? Do they read them and recognise the places and stuff?
I've only ever told a couple of my colleagues because I don't know how my management would actually react to knowing that I was an author in my spare time.
Right. Okay.
It's something that I've just never really spread around work. I mean, the ones who have read them, the two, I had a work husband and a work wife, mm-hmm. the people who run on my line with me at work, and they've really both enjoyed them. My work wife gives them to her mother, who then sends them around the entire caravan park where she spends half of her year. So it's nice to know that it's not just the lesbian, your normal sort of lesbian readership that are enjoying them. It's reaching, you know, they're being enjoyed by a wider.
Yeah, no, it's nice. Nice to know, isn't it? Yeah.
It is good. That.
Yeah. And you know, you can't control who reads you, and that's a good thing, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. and Sanna Jensen, the one of the main characters, has a Scandinavian name, but but as you say, was it sort of 5 foot nothing? Not from Scandinavia.
No, not at all.
Doesn't have blonde hair, and the reasoning is explained in the book, and I love that. I love those details. But. Did you magic that up out of thin air, or is that based on someone who has a name that just doesn't suit them?
No, it was basically magicked up by me as a little nod to my love of BBC4 Scandinavian dramas.
Okay.
I was a huge fan of sort of like Borgen and The Bridge and The Killing, the original one, not the rubbish American remake.
Yeah.
And I think I must have been watching Borgen at the time and picked Sanna's name from a cast list. I think technically she should be a sonner, maybe, in the actual sort of Scandi dialect, rather than Scanner, Sanna, but you'd never get a northerner pronouncing it like that, so
no.
she's a Sanna.
She's definitely a Sanna.
And like you say, it amuses me to have her called Sanna Jensen and then turn out to be a 5'4", brown-haired, scruffy northerner.
Yeah, no, that was really cool. And tell me about writing book two of the series. Did you always plan to write the two books from the beginning?
Well, yeah, like I said before, I meant it to be a series. Right. I set out to write it to be a series because I wanted to be able to give these women this sort of, you know, the shared history and be able to give them the details and the depth that you couldn't perhaps fit into one novel. But as usual, I do everything the wrong way around. So I submitted No Good Reason to Bold Strokes. And they accepted it and contracted it. And then I said, oh, by the way, can I carry this on? Unfortunately, they said yes. That's not the normal way of doing things.
Right.
But then I very rarely do things the normal way around.
And are we going to see more of these characters, or is that the end of them?
No, I'm writing a third. The third book will be called A Quiet Death. And I'm writing...
Another rom-com, then.
That's another one, yeah. It's a light-hearted rom through the Derbyshire Moors with Sanna and Meg. It's based around the discovery of a body of a young girl on the moors. And it's kind of it's whereas No Good Reason was very Peak District set and Cold was very urban, this is a bit of both. So you get a little bit of Sheffield and town setting and the moors as well. So I get the best of both worlds in this one. And it is set just a few weeks after Cold, the end of Cold, and it's due out, all being well, January 2017.
Okay, so quite a wait for everyone. They'll be on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, back to a year between books now, unfortunately. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. and as you said, you use like a ton of British and very northern colloquialisms. I don't think I've heard the term chippy tea before, but
get out.
No, I don't think I have, but I know what it means. and like you say, you're published by a US publisher. So how do they cope with all your northernisms? And does your editor tell you off a lot?
No, they cope quite admirably, it has to be said. That's one of the things I love about Bold Strokes, is that they publish me as is.
Okay.
I mean, Snowbound was my very first sort of very northern book.
Mm.
And I expected to get that back with a load of red pen. I didn't know whether they changed the setting. I didn't know whether they tried to tone down the colloquialisms and the dialect and the words that just, you know, possibly don't translate without Google Translate for an American audience. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of amazed to get that back with just a little note in the margins from my editor saying, yeah, we're going to go with English for this one. And that was that, really. I got to keep everything.
Cool.
Pretty much unaltered.
Yeah.
And I think you can tell just by reading the Dark Peak books, Cold and No Good Reason, that they've not been mucked about with. I mean, all my dialect, my slang, swearing, the weird British food stuffs, the settings, they're all as I wrote them. I mean, I'll get an occasional request to change something that absolutely doesn't translate, and my editor's quite good at picking up stuff that will, because she's American herself, stuff that will throw an American reader out of the scene, stuff mm-hmm. that make them wonder so badly that, you know, that they'll be actually thrown out of the page.
Yeah.
Things like, I put cold, a young lad was drinking a glass of orange squash, and she basically said to an American that that would just be a small pumpkin.
Yeah.
So, you know, little things like that yeah. that are obviously will just, that will mean something completely different than we work around.
Yeah.
But,
They don't have squash, do they, in America?
No, they don't. Yeah. I don't even know whether they have cordial, the equivalent word. I'm not sure what they have, to be honest.
No, it doesn't exist. Like, you know, you can't get a cordial out of water. It was
I know they have those weird cans of iced tea and lemonade.
Yeah, yeah.
But delicious, may I add. I do like the lemonade. The pink lemonade's lovely. So, but yeah, it's not. They won't get a bottle of Imta.
No.
In fact, well, I think I had Ribena in it, and we had to lose that because they didn't have Ribena either.
All right. And definitely not Iron Brew, I don't think.
Definitely not Iron Brew, no. Brews of any description, I don't think.
No. And do you get emails from people, you know, asking what stuff means, or is everyone just, you know, going along with it?
I think people just tend to go along with it. I mean, I did a bit of a snap poll on Facebook ages ago. I think when I was editing Cold, and maybe No Good Reason, because we were having issues with biscuits, and I'd put custard creams in, and my editor had said, nobody's going to know what that is. So I did a bit of a kind of chat on Facebook asking, A, whether anybody would know what custard cream was, and B, what biscuits were familiar to Americans over there. And it was quite surprising to know that most of our brands were actually recognisable to them. And if they weren't recognisable, then they were quite happy to look them up.
Mm.
You know, they didn't mind, they kind of liked the newness of things. I mean, it's like me, I like watching Man vs. Food and seeing biscuits and gravy and pulled pork and things that aren't necessarily on our plates over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with, you know, people using e-readers and everybody's online with a phone these days.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy to look stuff up. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of crossover, isn't there, between, you know, on TV, in books, in films. So, yeah.
And I think so many lesbics are American that it's a novelty to have something written in English.
Definitely.
Or Australian. They've got Australian authors now writing in Australian.
Australia?
Australia.
And have you, talking of biscuits, and, you know, you quite often, your characters, not you, quite often eat biscuits and have a brew. Have you been through and counted how many times you have a brew in the, or your characters have a brew in the books?
You could play a drinking game, couldn't you?
You absolutely could.
You're a sticky bingo, but I think you'd be sozzled by the end of the first chapter. I did actually go through Cold and did a little bit of brew thinning on the advice of my missus, who, said that there's a lot of cups of tea in this book. But brews are like the holy grail of the emergency services, though. You know, there's nothing better than a cadge cup of tea at 3 in the morning when you're freezing and you're knackered and your last patient's just trying to smack you. So, you know, it's just part of the realism. Every couple likes to have a brew in their hand. And if it's got a stolen packet of biscuits with it, then, you know, that's just a bonus, isn't it?
Frankly? All the better. That's where our NHS money's going, everyone. Stolen bourbons. Sorry. That's my phone. I'm going to turn it off. Should have turned my phone off, shouldn't I? Right. Like you said, some of your books got quite a lot of outdoorsy stuff in them, and I know that you're a great walker, a fan of the great outdoors. So, have you ever been in a precarious position while you've been out hiking?
I got one leg sucked right into a bog, does that count? Yeah. As I tell you what, once you get sucked into a bog, you're not getting out of that bugger without somebody pulling you out.
It doesn't sound very good, so yeah.
they're really quite scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Speed District bogs, and you can go into them. Like I say, thigh deep, luckily Kat was there and yanked me out. But if I'd have gone in with both legs, she'd have struggled.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, we've been... we got lost in the fog once on a walk that we were, you know, so familiar with we didn't really need a map for. And then the fog comes down and you basically, all your landmarks go. You can't see your trig points. You can't see the fence or the stile that you were aiming for. So that was lost to the point of actually using a whistle.
Right.
Nobody answered us, but, you know, we did actually give it a blow on the off chance that somebody was there and would be able to hear us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think there's just a lesson there with the peaks. You never take them for granted. You always go out with plenty of layers packed and your map and your compass and your survival bag, because you can, you know, it can literally be four seasons in one day. You never quite know what it's going to do.
Mm. Yeah, no. I remember me and my sister going out somewhere on, I can't remember exactly where, she lived in like near Leeds, and we went out for a walk and it turned very quickly wherever we were, and we turned around halfway through and retraced our steps and we were both shitting ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we did that. We went back the way we'd come and eventually found the path. I think I actually kissed the path. It had been that scary.
Yeah,
you never know how long you're going to be stuck out there for before it clears and you can get down again.
Yeah.
Plus, I have absolutely no sense of direction, so I'm not actually allowed out on my own.
Right.
I need somebody with me.
Good to know.
Good job about ambulances. I've sat down, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think at the end of our walk, when we got back, we'd parked in a pub car park, so we went in for a drink, you know.
Celebrate your...
Yeah,
freedom.
we're alive. So, like you said earlier as well, we're going to have to wait till next January for your next book. And you produced one book in 2011, one in 2012, one in 2014. But last year, you upped your release rate to two, with a full-time job too, which is very impressive. So what did you do? What was the difference?
Don't be fooled. That was actually just an illusion of scheduling. I'm afraid to tell you, it wasn't an increase in my work rate. I am probably strictly a one book a year kind of girl. Unlike most well-behaved authors, I didn't actually submit a proposal for no good reason. So you're supposed to let your publisher know what you're doing, send them a bit of a synopsis and a bit of a kind of overview, and they will yay or nay it and then put it onto the schedule for you and give you a deadline. But I don't really like writing to deadlines, and if I've got an idea in my head, the chances are I'm going to write it anyway. So I wrote No Good Reason and then sent it in.
Uh-huh.
And because I hadn't told them that it was pending, I didn't have a slot on the schedule. So I think it was 16 months before it actually got a release date.
Oh, right, okay.
During which time I wrote Cold.
Right.
So Cold was ready to go. And I had told them about that, and I had put a proposal in for that because I was confident enough that, you know, with what I was doing, that I could tell them what I was up to. So it got a place on the schedule and was scheduled quite soon quite hot on the heels of No Good Reason, which is good with it being a sequel because obviously people's interest is still peaked by that point.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah.
But now I'm afraid I am back to one book a year, so like I say, it's going to be January 2017 before the next one.
Oh, right. I thought you'd had some kind of superpower coming last year.
No, I can't. I mean, the shifts fry my brain to the extent, you know, there are weeks in a month where I just cannot concentrate on writing.
Yeah.
We work a sort of 12. Well, I do 12-hour shifts. I work a 6-6 shift, so that's 6-6 days and nights. And sometimes with a very quick turnaround between my days and my nights. So, yeah, it gives me kind of shift-induced Alzheimer's, really. I can barely remember my own name, let alone sort of plot a crime thriller.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I might be able to sort of type some stuff up or maybe edit, but I can't write from scratch.
Yeah.
When I'm feeling that kind of befuddled, really.
Yeah. So do you have a writing process, or is it just when you're feeling sort of clear-headed and stuff?
Yeah, a lot of it is when I'm feeling clear-headed. If I'm not in the mood, I don't try and force myself to write. My process is basically sit down and see what happens. I don't set myself any kind of word count. I don't have you know, any ambitions to that. These people who put their word counts on Facebook, you know, I've done 2,000 words today, I'm thinking, I wrote a sentence. But it was all good and I'm keeping it.
It's fried gold, though, that sentence.
Yes,
fried gold.
Yes, no, I'm not losing a word of that sentence I managed to write. I write longhand. I'm very old school. I write in a pad with a pen, with a proper biro. Mainly because I like writing outside. In the summer, I'll sit outside on the bench in the garden with the cats and write outside. And you can't do that with a laptop. So,
no.
I'll write longhand, and then I will copy it up onto the computer. Then I'll print out what I've copied up, edit that, and type up the changes again. That is my kind of technical writing process.
Right. Okay.
The rest of it. I mean, I'm much more of a plotter now than I ever have been. I think that's the difference with writing crime. You kind of have to know where you're going in advance. You've got to have all your ducks in a row at the start of it, so I will have a pretty good idea of who done it, how they did it, and where the book's going. And I will fool myself and try and write a plan, and then I will not stick to that plan because I'm useless. But I will always have a kind of loose idea of where the book is going, because I mean, you have to with writing crime, I think, with writing anything that's quite plotty and quite twisty, you've got to know where those twists are coming.
Yeah.
So in terms of the main story beats, I'll have those worked out in advance. I'll know what's going to happen to the characters. I mean, I've known how this one's going to end. I've had the image of the sort of like the final scenes in my head since before I started it. And sometimes that can just be enough to trigger off a story idea as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. No. I think as well, as you go on, you start plotting more. Well, I think that's what I'm doing anyway. So, you know, I used to just sit down and write, but now I'm getting more into plotting. So, and it's good because you kind of, if you know what you need to write, it's easier to then write it.
Yeah. I mean, it was so bad. I just sat down and wrote because, like I said, that was never intended for anybody but Kat to read.
Mm.
Which kind of explains why it's a book of two halves, really. You've got one half of the hostage drama and then one half of the hospital and the falling in love kind of scenario. It's kind of strangely plotted, snowbound. In terms of sort of like the technical aspects of writing and plotting and characterisation, I think I've probably come quite a long way since then.
And do you panic at the end of every book and think, oh shit, what am I going to write now? Or do you have a well of ideas that's always springing?
No, pretty much I sit there and think, oh shit. I was okay with No Good Reason and then Cold. I had Cold sort of set out really while I was writing No Good Reason. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with the characters in that. I'd left No Good Reason open. I didn't feel obliged because Meg and Sam, you know, were they're best friends who sleep together, but they weren't in a relationship per se. I didn't have to give them a happy ending because it wasn't a romance. So it's very liberating writing No Good Reason.
Yeah.
And then doing what the hell I wanted to do in Cold, which obviously when it was published kind of raised a few eyebrows and I got a few shrieks for what I did with Cold. But no, those two were set, I think. They were quite set in stone. I was quite happy writing them. And then A Quiet Death has been a little bit, It's been more difficult, I think. I think real life got in the way a little bit, and I just wasn't as confident with where the story was going. I didn't have it all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So that it took longer for me to get going on that one. It took longer for me to get the plot in my head and just get started on it, really, as well.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what I'm going to write after it. I don't know whether I'm doing book four. I don't know whether I'll go back and do a standalone. So I'll see what happens, I think. See what happens and how I feel at the end of it.
Yeah, you're fluid. You're fiction fluid, you know.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I don't know. I just made it up, but it's pretty good, right?
It's organised, I think.
I like it. I'm going to go with that one. And also, together with Claire Ashton, you write the hugely popular and very entertaining as well UK Lesflick blog. So how did that come about?
Folly of Jew, to be honest. God, it's been so long I can't even remember how it all started. I was chatting with Claire and we got quite friendly And I think we were chatting about how nice it would be to have a resource where all British writers of lesbic, you know, could be listed, basically, that people would have somewhere to come to find an up-to-date, comprehensive list of who is writing lesbic and lesbian fiction in the UK. So having sort of like mentioned it and thought about it, we then decided that we would go ahead and do it. Somewhere, you know, to create somewhere where readers could go to discover new people they wouldn't have heard of, and create this kind of community. And I think it's kind of worked like that. I mean, I've got mates like yourself that I would never have known about had we not put the blog together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to this nice place now where authors are actually coming to us and asking to sort of like write stuff and be involved. So yeah, it's taken off. It was a monster to start with. We wondered what the hell we were doing, because there were so many people that we just didn't know about.
Right.
Once we started looking, you know, it was like scratching the tip of the iceberg, really. It was a bit of a beast. But now we've kind of got it into this pattern of news updates and the occasional multi-author feature and author blogs, giveaways, and it's settled down a bit, and we went every 2 weeks with the news, because it was a bit much for us to be trying to pull it together every week. So I do one news a month now, which is much better in terms of my work and being able to write myself as well.
Yeah, but it's still quite a lot of work, I would think, even bi-weekly. But I suppose there's two of you doing it, so it's kind of shared out.
Yeah, we'll put a draft post up. There's a draft post out there now, basically. And when we see things, we'll add it as we go.
Wow.
The link,
mm-hmm.
which helps. It's very helpful for people like yourself with... You're one of the best authors we have, because you will actually tell us when you've done something, when you've put a new blog up. A lot of other authors kind of just rely on us to pull it off the interweb, which, you know, we can do, and we do, but then we miss stuff. So it's much better if you get in touch.
Yeah.
And easier.
I'm just a blabbermouth. I like to tell people, so, you know.
Well, yeah, tell us, absolutely. Then you get featured, you know, and people know all about you, so it's great.
No, it's a fantastic resource, and I remember, you know, when I started on my writing journey, it was one of the first things I saw, and I was like, wow, all these people, who knew? Yeah, because like you say, a lot of lesbian fiction that you see is mainly American, so it was quite cool to find all these other UK lesbian fiction authors.
And it pisses me off when you see things like The Guardian, who, you know, did a feature ages ago bemoaning the lack of lesbian writers in the UK. And they did a feature recently, somebody who'd won something. They usually get them to write a piece, don't they? And they were writing about best sex scenes in LGBT fiction, and they didn't go outside the usual, you know, Emma Donoghue and Sarah Waters and Ali Smith, and you're just thinking, just look a little further.
Mm.
You know, there's loads of us out there writing.
Yeah.
They're not doing lesbian fiction any favours by just sticking to the narrow kind of obvious authors.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, totally agree. And what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given?
Probably all of the red pen that my editor put on Snowbound.
Right.
You know, you get your first book back and have a bit of a heart attack, basically, because it looks like some kind of surrealist nightmare. The advice that she gave me, advice about things like head hopping and point of views and dangling modifiers and the what I call impossible ings, you know, the sentences that go along the lines of sort of closing the door as she walked into the hallway, you know, things that are impossible to do together, but everybody writes like that. You know, I'd written like that when I was writing fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that she pointed out that, you know, I didn't know I was doing, and now that I know I'm doing, I don't do anymore. That was probably her advice on that first manuscript. Once I got over the, oh my god, I'm never going to get this right, how, you know, where do I even start trying to fix this, it was the best advice I've ever had.
Yeah.
And I think I've come on. I mean, I look at Snowbound, and much as I love it, it's quite rough around the edges in terms of its writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've come on sort of leaps and bounds since then.
Yeah.
Just in confidence as well, you know, confidence to tinker with the mould a little bit with no good reason, to, you know, to have two characters who already know each other and already sort of like sleep together and know all their secrets. You know, they're not the usual girl meets girl, falls instantly in love kind of trope that you get in lesfic. You know, to just have the confidence to muck around with things a little bit.
No, absolutely, yeah. And that was a really cool element of both books. And I've never seen it before.
They're such good fun to write. I absolutely love writing them. They're really, you know, and a lot of that is because I can imagine the shared history that they have. You know, the little memories and scenes that crop up. I can give them the in-jokes and filter in the details about the childhood and just let them take the piss out of each other.
Yeah.
You know, they have sex, but they've got this comfortable intimacy where they can muck around, so it's not the be-all and end-all of everything.
Yeah. I loved her sister's kids all beginning with the letter K. That was brilliant.
I had such fun giving her new baby a name. I'm not gonna tell you what it is, but it tickles me. It's great. And that's in book three. That comes out in book three. She drops the sprog in book three.
Drops the next one.
The Asti Spumanti baby.
And the final question, if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose?
Oh my God. Any two writers. I think possibly Roald Dahl, because he's just got that wicked sense of humour that just appeals to me. He's got that twisted little sense of humour that I love.
Yeah.
And sticking with, I think, childhood authors, Enid Blyton, because her love of midnight feasts and adventure just shaped my childhood. So God knows what their love child would actually look like, but I think it would probably be quite adventurous with a sense of humour. So
yeah.
Let's go with that.
Adventurous and sarcastic, I would hasten
yes,
to add.
Yes,
and they'd be lashings of ginger beer and cake, so you'd be all right.
Oh God, I used to love her midnight feast. I would always try and have a midnight feast as a kid, and we'd fall asleep at like 10:30 with a Mint Aero clutched in my fist kind of thing. I'd never get to midnight as a kid. I was always gutted, and I never had potted meat. I had no idea what it was. But yeah, I think her love of food basically probably translates into my books, because she wrote so beautifully about food.
Yeah.
Always made me hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, looking back on it, you're right. You're very right. Cool. I loved a bit of Famous Five. I was
more the Island of Adventure and the Castle of Adventure, that series. I love those books.
All right, okay. Cool. Well, this has been fantastic, Carrie. Thank you very much for taking the time. And I will all be on the edge of our seat waiting for instalment 3 of the Dark Peak series.
I hope so. That'd be nice.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claire. Cheers.
And I did forget to ask Carrie where people can find out more about her. I really must remember to start asking that one. But anyway, I will tell you where you can find out more about Carrie. It's at carriehunter.wordpress.com. And that's her website. You can also find her on the Boldstroke Books website. And she's also on Facebook under Carrie Hunter. So there you go. That's how you can find out more about Carrie. Well, that's the end of this Lesbian Book Club. So this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. As always, if you fancy dipping into any of my books, All I Want for Christmas or All I Want for Valentine's, the London series, which is London Calling or This London Love, or my other standalone novel, The Long Weekend, you can find out more at www.clairelydon.co.uk, or just look me up on Amazon, Kobo, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, or any of the other digital outlets. I'm also on Twitter and love a new follower, so I am at Claire Lydon. Come on down and follow me there, and we can have a chat. We can get to know each other. It's going to be great. And if you'd like to sign up for my mailing list and get a free short story, yes, a free one, for your efforts, go to my website, again, clairelydon.co.uk or clairelydon.com, and enter your email in the lovely pink box there, and I'll send you the short story and I'll send you news of new releases as well as any offers that I'm running. So that'll be awesome. I'm also on Facebook, so Claire Lydon Author, so find me there. Thanks to Denise at My Lesbian Radio for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And make sure you tune in to The Lesbian Lounge with Denise for all the latest LGBT news, views, interviews and gossip. She had Philip
Phyllis Nage, on, who wrote the screenplay for Carol and her most recent one, which was an ace interview. And that was, yeah, really cool. So make sure you're listening to that. Join me in February for more hot book club action. See you then.